You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to our weekly AL Central podcast. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, here once again to talk ball with you as we get ready for spring training. Now in the month of February, so it won't be long before camps open in Florida and Arizona. And we're going to check in with all the beat writers from the AL Central to get the latest news and notes. And we're also going to play a little game. Which player is most likely to blank? I'll throw out the category. They'll throw out the player. We'll have a little fun predicting elements for 2016. So thanks for tuning in. Here we go. Jeffrey, you got a story up on MLB.com this week about Alex Gordon. We talked a bit about that second spot in the lineup and how Ned Yost might handle it. Obviously, Mike Moustakas held the role for much of last season, and then Ben Zobrist after he came over at the trade deadline. But Alex Gordon sounds like wants that number two job.
Yeah, you know, he's one of those guys, he's a good soldier. He'll hit anywhere in the lineup. And over his career, I think he's hit just about everywhere. And but I asked him if he had a preference, and he said it would be up in the order. And so, you know, that would be the number two spot's open right now, as you mentioned. It's really probably going to come down to either Moose or Gordon, and they'll probably figure that out in spring training. But I think Alex he's hit leadoff so much in his career, and he likes it up there, and I think he would be pretty happy being back up in the two spot.
Another item of note with the Royals right now, we've talked about this before as well, but Salvador Perez's contract is widely regarded as one of the most team-friendly contracts in the game right now. Of course, the Royals and Sal signed it very early in his career, and now definitely rates as a bargain for the team perspective. How close are these two sides potentially renegotiating that and figure out something that's more palatable for the player side?
Well, I talked to Sal about at the Fan Fest over the weekend, and he did confirm that his agent and the Royals have had talks. The Royals, of course, are not confirming any of that, so it's really hard to tell how far they're progressing. You know, back in the beginning of the offseason, it did not seem like a very high priority with the Royals, but you know, they've always been the type of team that wants to keep their players happy, and you know, that deal is, you know, now it looks very, very club friendly. You know, but I'm kind of torn because when that deal was signed, as you mentioned, you know, it was kind of a risky thing for the Royals. I mean, he only had, like, you know, 39 games under his belt, and they were locked into, you know, at least $7 million for a guy they didn't know a whole lot about, and they traded, you know, free agency for security, and you know, Sal was going to be hooked up for possibly 7 years, so, or 8 years, I guess it was. So, you know, and Dayton's mentioned that too. It was a risky venture, and I think within 2 weeks after he signed it, he tore a ligament in his knee and was out 2 months. And so, you know, it was kind of a scary couple months for the Royals. They just signed him, and already, you know, he's blown out a knee. And so, but now, you know, he's a bulldog. He's been healthy. You know, I think he's averaged something like 143 games over his last 3 years, and he, you know, would certainly like a deal that, you know, is more comparable to his talents.
Yeah, reigning World Series MVP, he's going to make $2 million in 2016, and then the option years kick in, and that's a total of $14.75 million over 3 years for the three club options. Crazy good contract for the Royals right now. But I guess, Jeffrey, got to think about setting a bad precedent of some sort. I mean, there have been reworked contracts in the past, but not many. And certainly you don't hear much going the other way where a contract
exactly.
Is signed that becomes very much club unfriendly. Player doesn't exactly reach out about reworking those. So it's kind of a prickly situation in that regard.
Yeah. You know, I think it's happened one time that I can recall. Gil Mesh gave back the final year of his contract. But other than that, you know, if the player has, you know, if he underperforms, he's not going to give money back. So, you know, it does to me kind of set a bad precedent. But maybe this one is just so over the top club friendly that maybe they even start to feel a little bit guilty about it. And considering you know what Sal has done, you know, his All Star appearances, MVP of the World Series, maybe that just kind of got to him.
All right, Jeffrey, in absence of any other hard news with the Royals, we're going to play a little game here this week. Which player is most likely to blank? So I'll throw out the category.
Okay.
Let me know which player you think fills that category best. looking at the Royals' rotation, which one of these guys is most likely to throw a no-hitter or a perfect game in 2016?
I would probably have to say Yordano Ventura, just because he probably has, in the rotation, at least he has the most dynamic stuff. And this is a year, we said this last year at this time, but this is a year they really want him to, you know, make a big step forward in his career, and he's got that kind of ability.
And sticking with that group, who's, or even in the bullpen, the longest scoreless inning streak, who do you think is most likely to drop that out?
That's got to be Wade Davis. You know, he could probably throw 50 in a row without giving up a run.
Any guys strike you as maybe most likely to lose a spot in the starting rotation?
Probably, I hope Danny's not listening, but probably Danny Duffy, because it's happened the last 2 years. And,
yeah,
you know, if he does win a spot in the rotation in spring, you know, maybe he struggles again. But I hate to say that, because he's another guy they're really hoping makes a big leap forward and you know, solidifies his spot in the rotation. But just from past history, he'd probably be the candidate.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I also say he might be the biggest X factor on this club when you think about 2016, because we know the talent there. You know, his ability to maybe take that rotation to another level if he can tap into that, or who knows, maybe he ends up in the bullpen. We'll see. All right, so from the offensive side, most likely to hit for the cycle?
Got to be Lorenzo Cain, just because of all the different talents he has at the plate. You know, he can hit triples, and obviously he can hit home runs too.
Most likely to hit a grand slam, not an easy feat in Kauffman Stadium in general. Who's most likely to pull that off?
I'm gonna reach out a little bit. I'm gonna go with Mike Moustakas. I know he hit at least. I didn't look this up, and I should have. But he hit at least one last year. He might have hit a couple, but he tends to come through with the bases loaded.
And while you mentioned Moose, I mean, any thought about an extension possibility there? I know he's a Scott Boras client, but that's another guy who obviously you think about in that vein when you talk about contracts and stuff.
I don't know if it's. You know, I asked him about that over the weekend too, and he did confirm that, you know, they've talked about at least a 2-year deal, which would buy out the last 2 years of his arbitration, and basically the Royals do that fairly regularly. They did it with Lorenzo Cain, they've done it with Hosmer, they've done it with Herrera. Just kind of wipes out the aggravation of arbitration, and I don't think at this point, especially if they're going to, you know, renegotiate Sal's contract, they're looking at anything longer term at this moment with Moose, but. I do think the 2-year deal is in play.
In the absence of hard news involving the Twins, we're going to have a little fun interactive game ourselves here. A little most likely to. I'm going to throw out a category. You tell me which Twins player is most likely to fulfill that category in 2016. First one I'm going to throw at you. Who is most likely on this club to throw a no-hitter or a perfect game in 2016?
That's a good one, I think. Well, I guess I'll go with the guy who's already done it then. I know Irvin Santana's already thrown one back when he was with the Angels against the Royals a few years ago. So I'll go with him. I think that he's probably the kind of the veteran of the staff, and on paper, probably the opening day starter, so probably their best pitcher. So I would go with Irvin Santana.
I was at that no-hitter, actually against the Indians, and it was one of those where, it was just one of those where you literally do not realize you're watching a no-hitter until the seventh or eighth inning. You're like, wait a second, you know?
Just like Liriano, yeah. It's funny.
Yeah, exactly. Who's most likely to hit for the cycle?
Well, that's another good one. I think the Twins have so much, you know, speed on their roster with so many young guys. You could easily see a guy like Byron Buxton do it. I don't know if he has the power quite yet. He's still kind of developing that. So I think a guy who has a little bit more power than him at the moment would be a guy like Eddie Rosario. Rosario had so many triples last year. That's always the hardest part is getting those triples. So I think. We know Rosario can hit triples. I think he's probably the most likely, but you could make a case for, you know, Eduardo Escobar or even Brian Dozier as guys that have a little bit of speed and power too. But I think Rosario might be the most likely to hit for the cycle.
Somewhat along those lines, a 2020 season, 20 homers, 20 stolen bases. Do you see that in the cards for any member of this roster?
Well, Brian Dozier did do it 2 years ago. First time I think someone on the Twins had done it since Torrey Hunter.
Yeah.
Last year, I think Dozier only had about 12 stolen bases. So unless Dozier really kind of picks it up in the stolen base category, it might be a little tougher for him, but I could still see it happening. Rosario kind of comes to mind as well. I think Rosario only had 12 home runs last year, and obviously not the whole season. So if Rosario, you know, were to be able to hit 20 home runs, which I'm not quite sure that he could get to that plateau, he would certainly have a chance as well. But I think there's probably the two most likely guys. I don't know. It'd have to take some more power from Rosario, a little bit more speed from Dozier.
Going back to the pitching side of things, how about the longest scoreless inning streak?
I think the last year the guy that had the longest one was Kyle Gibson. I think when Kyle Gibson really gets rolling, I think he's got a chance to do that. As a guy that, you know, doesn't give up very many home runs, you know, keeps the ball on the ground. If he gets into a groove here, especially if he can kind of get his strikeout numbers up a little bit, which he did late in the season last year. I think the second half, his strikeout rate definitely was a lot better. I think he kind of got a little bit better feel and command for finishing his pitches. I think Gibson makes the most sense just because I think sometimes the scoreless streaks can just go away, you know, on one bad pitch. Guy hits a home run and there he goes, your scoreless streak. I think with Gibson, the fact that he can keep the ball in the ballpark, and I think he's going to take a big step forward this year, I think Kyle Gibson's got the best chance to do that.
And a streak of a different sort, a hitting streak. We know nobody's going to threaten Joe DiMaggio, but who's going to have the longest hitting streak of 2016?
Well, I'll go with Joe M then instead of Joe D. So I think Joe Mauer's got a chance here with a longer hitting streak. I think much as last year, in the last couple of years, he's kind of been down a little bit offensively. Last year he had a pretty long hitting streak, and he also had a really long on-base streak, where he at least, you know, drew a walk or had a hit. And I think a lot of games last year, I think, was the second longest in the majors. So I think as much as, you know, Mauer probably is never going to be quite the player that he was, I still think he's a guy who's still their most consistent hitter in terms of hitting for average. So I think Mauer's got the best chance to be that.
Seems like he had some interesting thoughts from Twins Fest just about the adjustment it takes at his age and experience level, you know, to go out there. And we all know, as you said, I mean, he's not going to be the player he once was, but he certainly seems to embrace the idea of making adjustments at this stage in his career.
Yeah, he really does. And I think even the last couple of years, he's changed, you know, his off-season routines, that kind of stuff, knowing that he's not a catcher anymore. He's really worked a lot more on kind of staying healthy and kind of changing his routine in terms of kind of even stretching and just being a little more limber. Last year, it seemed to really help him in terms of staying on the field. Didn't really have any injury problems at all last year. That's kind of when he changed his routine. So now I think for him, it's just kind of a matter of continuing to adjust and see if he can become, you know, a better offensive player. Because the Twins still believe, I don't think anyone really thinks he's going to get back quite to that MVP level or anything, but I think the Twins still believe he can still be a slightly better hitter than he's been the last few years. So for him, it's going to be adjustments, and I think some of it he's talked about even, you know, the strike zone and being smarter about, you know, the pitches that he's taking and swinging at. Obviously in the past, as a young hitter, that was probably his best quality. And I think maybe a little bit of the changes in strike zones and everything kind of messed him up a little bit. So I think, yeah, just always a game of adjustments, and Mauer's been trying to do that, but we'll see how the results end up being this season.
We are talking Tribe. It is February. We are dangerously close to spring training camp opening up in Goodyear, Arizona. JB will be there, and you were also at Tribe Fest, good buddy. Any general takeaways from the Tribe Fest event? It was a very high turnout from the roster. In fact, off the top of my head, I can only think of a handful of players I didn't see there. From the projected 25-man roster. It was a good turnout.
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, it was sort of, I guess, a blessing and a curse this year that they're doing renovations at the ballpark. You know, it was kind of unfortunate that they had to move the venue over to the hotel, but, you know, they were dealing with sort of a low amount of space compared to what they had the last couple of years, and yet they were able to sell the event out, and it was pretty packed, and you know, like you said, huge turnout from the players, and seemed like everyone had a pretty positive reaction to the event again. I think it's been good for the team to have this centrally located event over the last few years. It's convinced a lot more players to kind of take time out of their off season to come to Cleveland and take part in the event. And, yeah, it's good for everyone involved and kind of, you know, drums up that excitement a little bit for spring training. And I mean, I'm driving around right now. It's 50 degrees out. I got no coat on. I'm ready to go to Arizona. So let's go.
Let's go. It won't be long. But yeah, it doesn't have the usual, I got to get out of Cleveland feel to it. But it'll still be nice to get in the sunshine a little more. You know, there wasn't a tremendous amount of hard news that came out of Tri-Fest, although,
you know, to me, the biggest takeaway was just seeing Michael Brantley. You and I were both at that little informal mini camp they had, you know, before the Tribe Fest event. And obviously, he's not hitting at this juncture, having had surgery on his lead shoulder just in November. But he's also not walking around in a full body cast or anything like that, so that's good. His arm's not in a sling. His arm is, in fact, attached to his body, so that's good. You know, you don't read too much into what we saw, but it certainly didn't look like the second half doomsday scenario we heard trotted out in some corners around the time of the winter meeting.
No, it was definitely good to see him. And I mean, when we went to the little mini camp event where, you know, I think it was like 20 players got together to do a sort of team building workout ahead of spring training. It was like spring training in a field house. Going there, I didn't really expect that he was going to be taking part. You know, I expected him to be there, but I wasn't sure what we were going to see in terms of activities. And he was out there playing catch and running and doing all the drills and, as you mentioned, doing everything but hitting. And, yeah, I mean, that was a big positive. I think we were all kind of surprised at the level of activity we saw. Granted, it is his non-throwing shoulder. But I think it'll still be interesting to see how they play this. You know, he's going to try and push to get back as soon as possible. The Indians are going to play it conservatively because he's so valuable, not only for them this year, but, you know, going forward. And, you know, I had a chance, as you know, Jim Thome was there for the Indians Hall of Fame announcement and was chatting with him, and he was asking about Brantley, and he was speaking to the, you know, just how important that lead shoulder is for a swing, you know, and it's just, it's critical for a batter to be able to keep that bat steady through the zone. You know, and so, you know, it's, while people may look at it and say, oh, it's a non-throwing shoulder, you know, when it comes to Michael Brantley's swing and the consistency he's had over the years, it's a critical shoulder for that swing, you know, and I think that was why, you know, the Indians have kind of put this conservative timetable on it and why you're not going to see him rushed through a hitting progression. They're going to want to make sure he's at completely full strength before he's back.
Yeah, it's almost like you don't want him to feel too good too fast because it could lead him to do something dumb. So hopefully he'll be smart with it. I expect him to be smart with it.
Other takeaways from TriFest, had some time with the skipper, Terry Francona. And for me, JB, standing there was one of those where, like, you almost don't want to use up all your questions. You particularly, you're going to be there down there for 6 or 7 weeks. You know, one thing that did come up is just the look of the lineup. And as we sit here today, beginning of February, it's hard to peg any one guy to one slot, in part because of the Brantley situation being uncertain as far as, you know, his, when he'll be back in that lineup. But just in general, I mean, they don't have obvious fits for obvious spots at this point.
No. In the second half last year, they had a really good thing going with Kipnis, Lindor, and Brantley in those 1-2-3 spots. Obviously, Brantley being out of there creates sort of a dilemma. So Kipnis, I mean, he's been the number three hitter before. That's what he was mainly in 2013 when he was an all-star for the first time. Lindor seemed to have a home in the number two spot, and Francona has shown a propensity for going with a switch hitter there. It was his Drupal Cabrera and then Nick Swisher, and he tried Carlos Santana, and, you know, now Lindor, all of those guys switch hitters. So you could see Lindor there. Maybe he toys with the idea of putting Lindor leadoff and trying Santana again in the number two hole. You know, you got Rajai Davis who could lead off and said that he's most comfortable leading off. You know, maybe Kipnis comes to camp and says, hey, I really like leadoff. I want to stay there. You know, so there's a lot of elements at play for those first three spots. And then obviously the cleanup spot, you know, Carlos Santana's had his issues over the years there. So maybe Tito wants to take a little pressure off him, consider him for the five spot. Mike Napoli maybe cleaning up. You go 1 through 9, there's not one spot right now where you can pencil in a name with any kind of certainty. So I think it's going to be a long time before Francona sort of tips his hand as to what he's thinking along those lines. One thing he did mention, which I think kind of goes without saying given the construction of the roster, was that you will probably see more platooning early on in the year, you know, as they sort of fill the gaps until Brantley gets back. So that's where, you know, guys like Chisenhall and Colin Cowgill might be paired up, or, you know, maybe you'll see Abraham Alante and Rajai Davis paired up in center field a little bit. You know, they'll mix and match in left, maybe even at third base, Jose Ramirez and Giovanni Urshela, given their splits. You know, if they don't find a new third baseman before spring or before opening day, maybe that's what they try and do. So going to be some mixing and matching, and I think it could be a while before we kind of get a feel for what the best lineup will be for this team this season.
Not a lot of news, obviously, this week, so we thought we'd have a little fun and games on this week's podcast and do a little which player is most likely to blank. So I'll give you the category, and you give me the player most likely to fill that category in 2016. Are you ready, Jason Beck?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Okay, here we go. Who is most likely to throw a no-hitter or a perfect game? I know, of course, Justin Verlander has some history in this area. I'm curious if you'll go with JV for this one, or you got somebody else in mind.
Well, you know, they have somebody with that, another guy with that type of background now in Jordan Zimmermann, but having covered so many close calls with Verlander over the years, including a couple times last season, I'd have to go with Verlander on that one. I think you know, if he's near what his form was down the stretch last season, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we're sitting in a press box somewhere in the seventh inning looking at zeros up on the board and figuring that he's only got to go through the order one more time to finish off something like this and join some very elite company that way.
That's something he's very cognizant of. I remember when he had the one broken up last August that he said afterward, you know, Bob Feller, Nolan Ryan. He kind of rattled off the names of the guys who have done it three times. He very much seems to want to be in that category.
Yeah, he's very aware of the history there. And I think as he gets older, he's very aware of his place in history, at least potentially. And I think, too, to get something like that, I think would complete his point of saying that he could get completely back after all those struggles. You know, for the first few starts of last season, plus most of 2014, I think a lot of us last summer were thinking, you know, as he was trying to work out his issues, a lot of us were thinking and saying, really, that the days of Verlander threatening no-hitters all the time were probably done. But he proved us wrong there last summer, and I'm not going to bet against him as far as doing it again.
All right, looking at this loaded lineup, which member of the Tigers lineup do you think is most likely to hit for the cycle?
That's an interesting one. I would have said, you know, certain guys, like, you could see Cabrera doing it in his younger days. I don't think after all the injuries you can see him doing it now. You know, Justin Upton seems to have that combination where he could pull it off. And that's one of the things that's going to be interesting to watch with him is to see how playing in this type of ballpark with those gaps, you know, what that does for his triples and whether he can capitalize on that. I think he could be an interesting play on that. I think Ian Kinsler has run a cycle in him, you know, the way he hits the ball. You know, Cameron Maben even, although we're kind of waiting to see how his power will translate in Comerica Park as well. Cameron Maben on a given night could make a real play for something like that. But I think I'd go with Upton at the top of the list.
Well, I have a hunch he might be your answer to this next one too, the 20 homer, 20 stolen base season. Obviously, nobody did that for the Tigers last year. The only guy with 20 stolen bases was Anthony Gose, and he obviously did not hit 20 home runs. Do you think Upton is a candidate for that, or anybody else jump out at you for that?
Yeah, I think he's about as strong of a candidate as the Tigers have there. I guess a lot of it depends on where he's batting in the order. If he's batting in front of Miguel Cabrera, then there's going to be a pretty strong interest in keeping him on the bases, not risk him having, you know, getting thrown out on the base pads with Cabrera up, and plus not leaving first base open potentially for Cabrera to get walked, depending on who's batting behind him. You know, that's always been a concern for whoever's been batting first or second in that lineup over the years. Since Cabrera's been batting third, I don't anticipate that's going to change a whole lot. But, if he bats further down, I think, he could have a lot of free reign to do a lot more running. And maybe that ends up happening. I don't know. I'm not sure it's going to happen right away, but that might be something where, if they make an adjustment to the lineup or do something unexpected, he might be able to put up those types of numbers on both sides.
Well, before the White Sox and Merkin head to Arizona, and while Merk was waiting for his cable guy, White Sox fans were waiting for some new developments on the hot stove market. And Merk, I just want to ask you, because we talk so much, the White Sox seem to me to be an obvious team to sign a guy with a qualifying offer attached to them. Now, as we record this, we're down to three of those guys, and Fowler and Dexter Fowler and Ian Desmond being the two that would have make any sense for the White Sox at all. But I think we kind of just say that haphazardly. Like they have the 10th pick protected. They have another pick that they're getting for Jeff Samardzija in the number 28 overall, I believe.
Right.
And then and another in the top 50, correct?
They're 10, 28, and 49 right now. I just wrote about this yesterday talking to Nick Hofstedler, who's their new guy in charge of the draft, real sharp guy. I mean, he was under Doug Lauman for many, many years, and Doug is still involved with it, and Nick worked a lot with the draft last year. But I think it's still in play. One thing, they had Sox Fest this past weekend, and there's a lot of talk about having one more move left and stuff like that. And you wondered if it was kind of, success platitudes, getting people fired up and that kind of thing. But it really does sound like they're working hard towards adding another player. I don't know if it's going to be a Fowler or Desmond, who both, could definitely help the team. But I think they're working. I don't think they've ruled out adding someone who would cost them draft pick compensation. That's a margin 28th pick. But I think, trade would probably be more likely. One thing Nick said in the article is that the good thing about having 28 is you kind of get a double bonus in this, dual revamping and, competing type of process they're going through. Whereas if you have a couple guys you like at number 10, but you think, well, we're not sold on this one guy at number 10, he still might be around at 28. He's not going to be around at 49 almost, assuredly. So
Yeah. That's
one of the things they're considering. They're weighing how this guy they draft at probably 28 fits into the program versus how someone you would sign can help them right away. That's kind of the balance they're looking at right now.
Yeah, lots of balance there, because it's not just a pick. It's also just the cap room that comes with having three picks in the top 50, the amount of money you have to play with in that
sure,
pool,
sure.
Which goes a long way. But then at the same time, I mean, these guys are still free agents into February, so those price tags are not where they were a couple months back. So there's the White Sox are in a good position to be one of those teams to potentially get good value there. So either way, they're in a good spot. It's kind of the benefit of coming off of a bad year and yet still being very much in a win-now mode. So we'll see how that all shakes out. But in the meantime, Merk, with not much else going on news-wise, wanted to play a little game with you. Most likely to blank. I'll give you the category. You give me the player most likely to perform that particular feat. Are you ready, Mr. Merk?
I would be most likely to do a podcast while table is being installed. That would be mine.
I actually did peg you for that exact category. So that one's taken care of. What's not taken care of, who is the most likely to throw a no-hitter or a perfect game in 2016?
Well, I think that's pretty obvious. I think you could probably put him at the top of the list for almost anyone in baseball, and that's Chris Sale. I think Chris Sale, pretty much every time he steps to the mound, has no-hit stuff. I would say, he makes 30 starts? Probably, legitimately, 25 times he has no-hit stuff. So
yeah.
I would think he goes. And he's also great kid, great leader for that team. So, yeah, I would say Chris Sale.
Yeah, I've actually seen, I can't remember who did this now off the top of my head. There was some kind of a ranking system, statistical system to figure out which players are most on the cusp for that kind of mark, and I believe Chris Sale was one of two or three guys at the top of that list, as you would expect. All right, how about who's most likely to hit for the cycle?
Excuse me. That's kind of, I would say Adam Eaton, because he's got the most speed on the team, I think, in the starting lineup, but I think he also showed a little bit of power last year, too. So I'm going to go with Adam Eaton on that one.
All right. And, of course, what do you think was the key as his season evolved? I mean, his second half was so much stronger than the first.
Excuse me. I think that he just kind of got his legs under him, not so much physically, but just kind of mentally after getting the new contract and I think pressing a little bit early on. And I think you could even notice this weekend the little I interacted with him at Sox Fest and just watching him kind of carry himself. I think he's already, you can tell, like just he's not calmer, but just more at ease. You know, he's into the contact now. He's there. He had a great finish. I mean, he finished, what, one or two runs scored short of 100. Tremendous finish. And I think this could be, you know, the start of an all-star season for Adam Eaton. I think he really has kind of got what's there, and I think it was just more of getting out of his own way kind of early on, which he kind of understood.
Well, it's good to see because he represents that team so well in every respect, and it was a struggle for him early on last year, of course, and they're hoping for big things from him and the rest of this lineup in 2016. All right, Merck, how about 20 homers, 20 stolen bases? Who's got that in them?
Well, I would say there's a couple. I think even, you know, Eaton is an outside shot for that. I think, you know, he reached double digits last year, very outside. I would think Todd Frazier is a candidate because Todd Frazier does have some athletic ability besides the power. So I think, you know, if they put the green light on him for a run a little bit. Now, obviously, a hot-button issue was a guy I wrote about last Thursday. Avi Garcia wrote about being in good condition, and suddenly that became best shape of his life, which was never really said in the article, but it did say that, you know, he came in good condition. And who knows, you know, with the Sox still looking to add more, if he's going to be the everyday guy or a platoon guy, but, you know, or you know, where he fits, period. But I think he has that capability. And then a guy in the minor leagues eventually may have that capability. That's Tim Anderson. I don't know what his, you know, power quotient is going to be. Right now, he's hitting more for extra base power than home run power. But he certainly has the speed, so it just depends on how his power develops. I would say probably Todd Frazier, though, of the active guys.
See, I think Avi Garcia should say he's in the best shape of his life. I think he should take that mantle from Russell Martin for many years. That was his thing every spring.
Yeah,
he was kind of the poster boy for best shape of his life. He did that every year. I think Avi should take over that title. It's good.
That was the
notoriety.
That was the Gordon Beckham thing for a few years. Not necessarily best shape, but, you know, ready to go, really has kind of figured it out. And, again, social media can take on a life of its own sometimes, can it?
It sure can. Well, you, with your new TV and your new glasses.
How about that? Yeah. And soon to be new. Who knows what's next after that? Yeah.
All right. Anybody who you think profiles as, and this is a negative one, but what the heck, things change all the time in starting rotations, who is most likely to lose a spot in the starting rotation this year?
Wow, that's hard to say. I mean, the first three guys are pretty well set. That's Sale, Quintana, Danks. I'm sorry, Sale, Quintana, Rodon. You know, I think Danks is there. You know, forget the money they're paying him. They know what they have in John now. You know, so, you know, he's more of kind of a, you know, not Burley type, because Burley has been a little more effective over the last few years. It has been more effective overall than Danks. But I don't think Danks is going to be dropped, because I think they know Danks is somewhere around a 4 ERA guy who's going to start 30 games and give you somewhere between 180 and 200 and, you know, 200 innings. So I would guess it would be Eric Johnson, and that's not a shot at Eric Johnson. I just think that they're still not completely sure what they have in him. You know, he came out and had the great finish before, let me get these years right, at the end of 2013, struggled mightily in 2014, both the majors and minor league level, came back last year, seemed to find a new confidence, and changes, you know, a little more fluid in his delivery, but just looked better on the mound. Didn't look like he was not fearful, but just looked like he believed himself on the mound. And now he comes in with a leg up for that fifth spot, but you have Carson Fulmer, who, you know, is in our top 100 in terms of prospects. So you also have, I'm blanking on his name now. Oh, my goodness. The guy they got from the Cubs. Jacob, I cannot believe it's not good getting old. But you have Carson Fulmer behind him, and, you know, he may be ready at some point during the year for all you know. So I would say Eric Johnson.